The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, December 7th, 2018. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, it's Casual Friday. Also, my sister's birthday. Happy birthday, Betsy. And joining us to celebrate my sister's birthday and the end of the week, David Dayen will be in studio. Also on the program today, Bill Barr, a smarter Jeff Sessions, to be nominated to the Attorney General of the United States of America. White House Chief of Sociopath John Kelly to be resigning soon. Michigan Republicans assault democracy Wisconsin style. And North Carolina's 9th Congressional District election fraud case boils over. Meanwhile, two big Mueller filings to drop later today. One on Manafort, one on Cohen. May tell us stuff, may not. And Trump to nominate a former Fox and Friends host to be the UN ambassador. Senate confirms a new head to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau who has zero experience with consumers or financial protection. And probably bureaus, for that matter. F you, Paul Lepage, says judge. Medicaid expansion will go forward. I'm not sure the judge said exactly those words. Written. Yep.
That was a great one.
More on the postal report. And Joe Manchin creeping closer to becoming the minority leader on energy and the face of Democratic fight against climate change. And lastly, the biggest questions for the new House to be answered today, arguably, on this version of the Majority Report. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is Casual Friday. It is also my sister's birthday. Once again, happy birthday, Betsy. David Dayen is in studio with us. We'll be with you in just a moment. It's very exciting to have you in studio. And we haven't quite figured out. Well, hello, David.
Oh, hello.
Yeah.
How are you?
Make you.
I didn't know if I was ready to come on yet.
No, you're ready.
Okay.
I don't know, David, if you remember Rex Tillerson.
I do.
Yeah, he was the former Secretary of State. People are very excited that he came out in public to. I don't think he properly maligned Donald Trump, but he did it in that, you know, that sort of like genteel way. Here he is with Bob Schieffer of CBS News. Bob Schieffer, obviously. He loves these. I mean, he's also from Texas, but he's a big, I don't know, he has a very good relationship, it seems like, with anybody who has oil. And the Bushes, he was good friends with. Here he is. It's unclear to me, like, what event it is. I don't know, some local, I'm sure, has to do with, you know, get-rich-quick scheme type of situation down there. But here is Bob Schieffer. And Rex Tillerson talking about Donald Trump.
You describe Donald Trump.
Well, most of you probably know some of this, but
I had never met Donald Trump until the day he asked me to be Secretary of State.
Pause
he
it.
Acts on his.
So, in other words, you know, I can't be held responsible for anything that I did. I claim I have total plausible deniability, right? Like, I mean, no one knew who Donald Trump was,
right?
Until at least after the inauguration, right? I mean, really, you had no.
He just sprung it on us.
It was completely, you know.
He was such a kindly man from the TV.
Of course, before. As Joe and Mika said, like he always used to be in on the joke, and now. But all right, let's hear Rex Tillerson continue to try and whitewash his culpability in this disaster.
The Secretary of State. He acts on his instincts. In some respects, that looks like impulsiveness, but it's not his intent to act on impulse. I think he really is trying to act on his instincts.
Yes,
well, it's challenging for me, coming from the disciplined, highly process-oriented ExxonMobil Corporation, to go to work for a man who is pretty undisciplined, doesn't like to read, doesn't read briefing reports, doesn't like to get into the details of a lot of things, but rather just kind of says, look, this is what I believe.
In other words, he just makes stuff up, and he doesn't want to be impulsive, but he doesn't have control of his impulses, so he is impulsive.
Right.
That is definitionally
that's
impulsive.
Acting without intention is, in fact, acting on impulse.
You know who also strikes me as not quite as bright as we might have given him credit for? Rex Tillerson.
To be fair, I never met him. I never heard him until just now.
Can't say whether
he's
you've
a complete idiot.
Judged him in any way.
Convoluted way of calling somebody an effing moron.
Can anybody remember the pseudonym he was using?
Oh yeah.
No.
I just remembered I can't remember it.
No, I don't.
I can't remember it either. Wow.
Wasn't his main breakdown with Trump though?
Wayne Tracker.
That's right. Where was he using that pseudonym? Was he like a sock? It was sock puppet. Like,
going into hotels because they were, you know, his teeny boppers were after him. Why was he using a pseudonym?
I can't remember what it was.
He was the one who got really upset with Trump's address to the Boy Scouts, which was
a
little questionable to talk about, like, you know,
hot tubs.
Hot tub parties with the Boy Scouts. But this guy
could all be yours.
He used Wayne Trecker to discuss climate in emails.
Oh, yeah, of course. There you go. I can't wait for that lawsuit. Folks, today one of our sponsors is Skillshare. And the first 500 people who go to skl.sh/majority, and like we said, now you're probably down to like 498 after we talk about it on the show. With David Dayen right now, headed right over to skl.sh/majority, are going to get 2 whole months of totally free access to Skillshare's entire library of super quality online courses and tutorials. Skillshare is a vibrant online learning community that offers courses on everything from design to video editing, photography, business, technology, cooking, meditation, and everything in between. There are Skillshare courses for everyone. You'll have no problem finding courses that's going to be useful for you both in your personal and your professional life. Whether you want to sharpen your skills with something you already love doing, or you want to learn to do something, totally new, Skillshare has you covered. They have courses for entrepreneurs, courses on computer coding, web development, personal nutrition, learning new languages, Photoshop, you name it. I got to make a note of that. I've been checking out their courses. I went through the knife cutting one because I wanted to learn, you know, like, well, there's actually like, you cut against the grain on certain things, and the taste of food changes on how you cut it and how it cooks as to what juices comes out.
All right.
Yeah.
It also just looks impressive when you're using a knife, right?
Yes. You gotta go slow, or you know you're gonna lose.
Sam's got to impress somebody.
Yeah, I got to impress people with my knife skills. I took that Google Analytics course, but as soon as I just saw Photoshop, that's the next one I think I'm gonna do. Get some Photoshop skills going. You can get 2 entire months of free access to every single course offered by Skillshare by going to skl.sh/majority. Just think of everything you'll have at your fingertips for 2 whole months. I feel like you could probably go through every single video, David, based upon
I'm
your
looking
work
up right
ethic.
Now, radio guest.
Again, that's skl.sh/majority. We've got a link in the podcast description, a link on the YouTube. Check it out. Also, reminder, 2018's been a difficult year for human rights, but have you ever wondered how rights abuses are documented around the world? You probably have. With the sheer volume of global crises we're seeing, from civilian casualties in Syria to ethnic cleansing in Myanmar to the caging of children on U.S. borders, it's critical that we expose the truth in order to defend the rights of all and bring those responsible to justice. Human Rights Watch does just that. They are an independent, nonprofit organization known for their accurate fact-finding, impartial reporting, and targeted advocacy, often in partnership with local activists and human rights groups. They accept no money from any government. They rely on the support of informed, dedicated people just like you. So if human rights are important to you, visit hrw.org/majority to make a donation and support its vital work around the world. When you do, not only is your gift tax deductible, it'll be matched dollar for dollar until 2019. That means your donation will go twice as far to advance justice and defend the basic dignity of people who need it most. Again, that's hrw.org/majority. Last night, we had charity night for our – this we do for one night of Hanukkah. Kids don't get a present. They can divide up the cash they would have gotten amongst charities. Mm-hmm. HRW, the Human Rights Watch, was one of those.
Nicely done.
Did a couple others. Oxfam. We did the Pacific Immigration Center, which we now do every year. But that's a different story. So, David, all right, let's get to this week in review. There's a couple things. Let's talk about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, because I know that's in your wheelhouse. I want to get, obviously, to what's going on in Michigan and, well, Michigan and Wisconsin. We spoke to Ari Berman earlier in the week, and things have simply progressed on the same trajectory. But we'll get to that in a moment. But let's talk about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, because this was, up until about 2 years ago, considered by many to be one of the most successful agencies, I don't know if in the history of the U.S. government, but certainly in modern times, and because of the way that it was financed, right? And personnel. Tell us why.
You mentioned the financing, and the point of that is that it was not financed through congressional appropriations, so it couldn't be you couldn't have the money spigot turned off. It was funded through the Federal Reserve, which guaranteed its resources. I think more so the reason that CFPB has been successful is because of sort of the way the agency was imagined. This is an agency with a mission that is entirely and singularly to protect consumers. Previously, these laws that it has jurisdiction and oversight over were put into agencies that had other missions, safety and soundness of the banks, things like that. And they were sort of at cross purposes with this mission of, you know, making sure consumers are getting a fair shake on these very important financial transactions.
It's probably designed that way on some level, right? That
absolutely.
It's sort of like a mitigating, like built-in.
Right.
Like the critique is built into the into the product,
and so you're weighing those two missions, and usually it comes out on the side of the group with the most money and most power and influence. This was distributed differently, and was also staffed differently. I mean, as you recall, for the first year, Elizabeth Warren was the person who stood up this agency, and she built the organizational chart. She created the ways in which the priorities were made for this agency. She staffed the agency at the very beginning. A lot of those people were still there through the first term of Richard Cordray, who was sort of the handpicked director. And so all of those things, I think, came together. It was seen as a new agency. It was vibrant. It brought people in who had a public service mission. So there were a lot of reasons why there were, you know, it was set up for success. And it was successful to a degree. I mean, I don't want to overstate it. There were some things I think that CFPB did where they kind of kept their powder dry, pulled their punches a little bit in rulemaking. But generally a successful agency until last Thanksgiving when Richard Cordray left to unsuccessfully run for governor of Ohio. And Mick Mulvaney, who was moonlighting, he was the director of, he was the White House budget director, who would come in 3 days a week to screw up the CFPB.
Much easier when you're screwing something up. It's much easier to
Be a short timer.
3 days a week.
You can be like a 9-to-3 banker.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, go out on the golf course after you destroy this agency.
Steal a
live I mean, horse on sport. Some level, I mean, I don't want to go off on a tangent here, but on some level, that is the entire sort of conservative project, right? And to get into government, destroy it, right. And it's you. It's so hard to be incompetent at being incompetent. Like, I mean, if you're
not quite though, because I've actually heard from some people that Mulvaney. I mean, we talk about Kathy Craninger. She's the woman who was confirmed yesterday and how she has no consumer protection experience whatsoever. And that's absolutely true. But it's not like Mulvaney did, right?
Right.
I mean, he was a congressman. He had no executive agency experience before this. He was a budget director. That's a very different thing than consumer financial protection. I'm not sure he was even on the Financial Services Committee in Congress. He was certainly a critic of CFPB, but that was mainly because of, you know, who was coming into
right.
his office. So he actually did not know the mechanisms by which he could, particularly on rulemaking, how he could undo those rules. So he would say to people in the office, hey, I want to get rid of this payday rule. And they'd be like, yeah, all right. And then they just kind of wouldn't do it.
Right.
So on rulemaking, he has not been quite as successful. Where Mulvaney was very successful is in enforcement.
Right.
And, you know, the Washington Post this week put out a pretty long article showing that enforcement was down 75%. It took several months for any enforcement actions to be brought by the agency. You know, there's this thing that the Washington Post attributed to people at the agency, but I wrote it 6 months earlier, called the Mulvaney discount. And the Mulvaney discount is these various enforcement actions where there would just be a reduction in the penalty.
That's the easiest thing to do, right? You get,
exactly.
You get it comes on your desk and it's like sign off on this $300 million penalty and you go, you know what? Drop this down to 25.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what we call this.
And that's exactly what was done. On up till today, you know, I
was there an algorithm or was it just he just picked a number he liked?
I mean, literally
90% reduction.
Literally, they would say in the enforcement documents that, well, initially we wanted 6 million, but we don't feel like this company that ripped off people has the ability to pay that. So we're going to drop it to 200,000. I mean, that's almost
fair.
Verbatim in,
wow.
in some of these documents. Going on up to yesterday, you know, the day that Craninger gets confirmed, CFPB did an enforcement action against State Farm Bank, the insurance company, but they also have a bank. And it was about credit reporting errors. They would report to credit reporting agencies incorrect information about customers.
Well, that's not a big deal for you to get a reduced credit score.
Right.
So much for the house or the car that you wanted or the loan to help your kid go to school or whatever it is.
So they reported this incorrect information, never corrected it, were delayed in actually getting that information out and finally reversing it, ruined credit scores. And the enforcement action, and I'm not being hyperbolic, this was the enforcement action. Promise not to do it again. It was $0.
Did they have to do that in writing, or they just
in writing?
That
compliance.
Well, okay.
You know, there's
okay.
compliance around not doing it again. $0 in fines. $0 in restitution to these people who had their credit scores ruined.
Wow.
And that was the enforcement. So, you know, I mean, there's a sense that oh, Kraninger's coming in. She has no experience. She's just going to ruin the ages. Ruin it from what? I mean, you know, right. Mulvaney has already really
They do seem to have a scheme to do this. But let me just also interject. From your perspective, right, there's no punishment for that agency. But I think libertarian philosophy tells us that, of course, consumers will stop going to that agency because they did this. State Farm Bank. They will go out of business now.
Right. So you'll never see State Farm commercials anymore.
Right. State Farm Bank will go out of business because why would people, why would anybody use them if they were doing that?
It's the discipline of the market is what you're talking about.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So
I should just add, I'm being facetious. there was a half dozen people out there.
So Kraninger gets confirmed. Yes, she obviously
thanks to Susan Collins,
woefully unqualified. A 50-49 decision. So all Democrats voted against this, and I guess Tom Tillis was absent yesterday for some reason or another, which means it was 50-49. So any one of the Republicans could have voted the other way, and she would not.
Because even if Mike Pence came down to vote, right?
50-49, it wouldn't have met. I mean, if Tillis is gone.
Oh, he's got to break a tie. Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So if it was 49-50, nomination fails. Now, there is a sense that it's not necessarily a good thing that Kraninger has been confirmed, but consider the alternative. So Mulvaney's there in an interim capacity. This is a 5-year term. And it's independent of who is in the White House. So Kraninger is confirmed today, December 2018. She has a 5-year term, will be there till December 2023, which means regardless of, whoever becomes president in 2020.
That's so depressing.
Kraninger is allowed to be there. Now, she's, there is a possibility to do a for-cause removal of the CFPB director.
Like you're obviously, not doing your job.
Obviously never been done before because it's a new agency. But, that's an option. If you have a President Warren, maybe she tries to do something like that. It's a little dice. I mean, you don't know if that's going to happen.
But at the very least, President Democrat who might win in 2020 will have the opportunity to appoint someone. As opposed to if this had gone 5 years.
But think about the alternative. So think about what if they, the courts decide, well, no, you can't. This isn't a cause. You can't fire them. So right now, Kraninger's there till December 2023. If they voted her down and Mulvaney just stays there and does the lack of enforcement he's doing and they don't fill it until the end of Trump's turn, then it's five, it's another couple years out.
Right.
So there was a school of thought that, let's confirm this person as quick as we can to get her out of there.
Right. It almost would have been better to do this a year ago because you just want to get it over as quickly as possible instead of.
That's a school of thought. But, you can see it both ways.
Okay. Let's just, before we move on to a different topic, Mick Mulvaney is saying that according to the charter, essentially, of this agency, that its name is not really the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. It is the Bureau of Consumer
Financial Protection. Yes.
Now, this is nuts. So he wants to change it to reflect the real name, which is going to require all of these companies, financial entities that file with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to refile with the Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection.
Right.
And at a cost of somewhere around $300 million.
There was a CFPB report that was put out to say what is the effect of the name change both on the agency, which obviously has lots of forms and things and, moving the B number from the beginning to the end. What's amazing about this is that he's literally taking consumers and not putting them first. I mean, that's literally what he's doing by doing that. So they did this report to show, how much is this going to cost the agency and then how much is it going to cost the firms who then have to do all these changes in their databases, changes in their compliance forms and things like that. And yes, what they showed is that it would cost the agency $19 million just to change the name. And it would cost regulated firms, regulated by the agency, up to $300 million.
And the purpose of this is to show how bad this agency is, right? Like that it's making people, it's causing unnecessary waste.
Yes, there's a sense that that's the point. Like the point is to cost $300 million to show how silly it is. But there's also just this like bizarre, like, well, actually what I found is that they've been naming it wrong. These stupid liberals have named it wrong this entire time.
It's just bizarre.
Elizabeth Warren's bad at naming things.
But I mean, I think the idea
By the way, Mick Mulvaney is – Mick is not his name. Mick is a nickname. His name is John Michael Mulvaney, and he's saying this is ridiculous that we're not using the statutory real name
of the
Consumer Financial Protection.
But it's not – he's not doing this out of like some type of OCD. He's doing this because they want to further – create animosity towards the agency and create an argument that this is an agency that's out of control and it's bad, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, this is sort of like, it seems to me, equivalent to the way that a Republican Congress deals with the postal office, right? It's like, you have no control over what you're doing. We're going to impose upon you certain obligations. You're going to have to pay out. You're going to have to fully fund your pensions system in your healthcare system for a 75-year horizon to pay for postal workers' retirement. Right. For postal workers who aren't even born yet.
Right.
It has to be fully paid. Right. There's no other entity, maybe in the world, that imposes that requirement on themselves or is imposed on that.
Right.
And it doesn't give the Postal Service an ability to deal with it. It's just a way to inhibit and kneecap them.
There's a somewhat alternate point in that Mulvaney's argument has been that CFPB is out of control. They have gone well beyond their statutory objectives. Nobody's reading the statutory language except me, John Michael Mulvaney, and they have overreached beyond the legislative intent. So what he's really saying is you have so ignored the legislative intent of this agency that you're not even naming it right. See here in this language that you've never read that it's wrong. The irony is that the Dodd-Frank Act refers to the Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection and also refers to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau in different parts of the statute.
Calls
so,
them the same thing.
So there's CFPB sometimes and there's BCFP as well. So, you know, under Mulvaney's standard, he could not sort of, for example, the agency is called CFPB in the context of putting the director on the board of the FDIC. So under what Mulvaney's saying, if it's called the Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection, he couldn't be on the FDIC board, right?
So if you're going to be that literal.
Right,
and, okay.
Exactly.
All right. Well, let's talk about the postal office because there was a postal report put out. This is we're hitting all of the stuff that
the most boring stuff.
Well, it's not
hitting.
It's a little bit drier. But I mean, this stuff is hugely relevant, and people can't get this information anywhere else. The only way they could do is read your Tumblr, and my understanding is that's going away because of the porno thing. So,
I will not use eggplant emojis anymore.
What's happening? What?
Tumblr has a new rule about getting rid of adult content, and I made a joke about that.
Sorry, I didn't know anything about
David
that. Sorry, Matt.
Oh, basically, okay. All the stuff remaining on Tumblr.
Right, exactly. Okay. And David Dayan's basically home for his clearinghouse of his reported piece.
Side
links, you know. I mean, they've been Tumblr's been flagging things like, you know, Taylor Swift sitting on a chair. Like, we don't know. We don't know. This could violate our adult.
Sam,
there was a flag on the postal report.
You're into that, right?
All right, yeah. Oh, totally.
It's Taylor Swift sitting on a chair.
All right, well, let's talk about the postal report, and then we'll get to what's going on in Michigan and Wisconsin.
Right.
And a little bit, I also want to talk about what's happening in the House. But the postal report came out. Who commissioned the report? What were the purposes?
This was a Trump executive order. So Trump put an executive order to start a task force on the future of the U.S. Postal Service, which has been losing money for a variety of different reasons that we'll go into. You mentioned one of them.
That's the biggest one, isn't it?
The pre-funding reasons.
Yeah.
I mean, what? But for that, they would be still, you know, on the road to profitability, if not profitable. But, you know, I mean, you know, email has degraded the ability of the Postal Service to continue. So this was a task force to determine. And now a lot of people saw it in the context of Trump going after Amazon, saying they were cheating the Postal Service, that they were underpaying for package delivery through the parcel post program. And so this was a task force designed to create recommendations for the Postal Service. It was seen at the time as sort of a stalking horse for privatization, which we've seen around the world at several postal services. They've privatized their agencies. I would say in the U.S., the Postal Service is a partially privatized agency. It does not get any money from the U.S. government outside of some very minuscule things for government postage. It has a board that's appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate, but they kind of have independent with some statutory restrictions, but they kind of independent governance.
Don't get taxpayer money.
No, $0.
It's all from the stamps.
So the question was, you know, was this task force going to recommend privatization completely? And it didn't actually recommend privatization, but it recommended something, I think, much worse.
Really?
And that is the degrading of the universal service obligation. Now, what is the universal service obligation? That means neither sleet nor snow nor dead of night will keep us from reporting rounds. It means that everyone in the country, every residence, every business, no matter where you are, no matter how much it costs to get there, gets mail. The furthest reaches of Alaska, the most rural area in South Dakota, or wherever, you're going to get your mail, and you're going to get it 6 times a week, and you're going to get a standard rate for letters from any part of the country to another, standard rate for packages and things like that. That's the universal service obligation. And what the report said is that we need to redefine the universal service obligation.
Those are my favorite universes, which don't include all of the universe. They're much easier to manage.
Yes, that's right. And there, you know, there's some contradictions in the report, because the report says that the one thing we don't want to do is hurt rural Americans who rely on the Postal Service, especially because the digital divide is still pretty large. But in practice, all of the things that it wants to do, which is they want to sort of define essential services. So like person-to-person correspondence, bill paying, government mail, transport of pharmaceuticals for some reason is in there. Those things would be essential services. That would still be universal. Everything else, like commercial packages, like from Amazon, would be inessential and then subject to increased rates, and also potentially subject to discontinuance of delivery. The term they use is exiting the business line. So they could – certain packages are like, I'm not going to middle of Alaska with that package. You can't do it in the Postal Service. So that would be and who would that fall on, right? It would fall on rural customers.
Of course, because it's going to be most expensive to go to a rural customers. And this is really fundamentally –
competition would start kicking in.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Competition would start kicking in, and then you would see just
already,
even
by
more
the way,
people not go there.
Already, UPS and FedEx don't deliver to certain places. There's FedEx has a thing called a delivery area surcharge, where if it's a hard-to-get area, they add money to deliver to that particular locality. So that's what you would see, a two-tiered system, basically.
That is, among other issues, that is one of the fundamental problems with privatization of the Postal Service, is that it is simply not profitable to do. And I don't know if you've seen any numbers to this effect, but there is probably 10 to 15%, maybe more, of what the post office does that almost cannot be profitable.
Right.
Like, I mean, you cannot have delivery service to the farthest regions of the country and make it profitable.
And when you're thinking about that, you have to think in terms of, what is the Postal Service for? Is it for making money for itself and for the United States? Or is it to, as it says in the statute, bind the nation together?
Right.
The whole point is to, you know, give everybody the ability to acquire information, conduct commerce, no matter where you live, no matter who you are, no discrimination against any member of society. You can use the Postal Service. Now, you know, in the 1800s, it was much more, much more vital part of communication. This is why, you know, magazines and newspapers have a reduced rate of delivery,
right,
relative to the other parts of packages and mail. But, you know, even today, particularly in these rural areas, it's incredibly important to have reliable mail service. And if you're saying to an area,
particularly because they don't have the same broadband of the internet, because now all of a sudden the sort of the digital divide adds to, if you were to diminish postal service, the divide that exists in terms of information because of the digital divide becomes that much even steeper, and disparate.
So while this didn't call for privatization, it embraces the logic of privatization.
Right.
The logic of, we have to turn a profit, we have to cover our costs on everything that we do, every little business line that we engage in.
If a Democratic president ever called for a report like this, and a report like this was produced during a Democratic administration, first off, I would be upset because it's fundamentally contrary to some of the points, right, of having a Democrat in office. But the New York Times would be writing about how the coastal elites think that the heartland people and rural people are not worth expending any money on. This would be a huge, like, we would hear this in the Senate. This would be the war on Christmas, right? It would be the war on rural people. But because it comes out of the Trump administration,
right,
nothing.
And by the way, I mean, it goes further than just not delivering certain packages. It says that it should be easier to close post offices. And where are those post offices going to be closed? There are 31,000 locations in rural areas it's unprofitable.
Yes.
It talks about slowing down the speed of processing mail in places where it's unprofitable. So maybe you can get your mail in a rural area, but it'll be once a week instead of
it'll
6 days a
going
week.
Going back to the Pony Express.
Yeah.
What about drones?
And
you guys are anti-future.
And then it talks about raising, you know, how can we make the Postal Service cover its costs, you know, revenue enhancement options. And it talks about, like, hunting licenses and fishing licenses you can sell at the post office. But it specifically says
no banking.
Yes. It specifically says expanding, I'll quote here, expanding in the sectors where the USPS does not have a comparative advantage or where balance sheet risk might arise, such as postal banking, should not be pursued.
Now, for folks who are new to the show, if you had listened to this show in like 2014 or 15, you would have heard probably more about postal banking than in any other medium that existed except for print.
It is why your audience was cut in half during that era.
Exactly. And had Hillary Clinton won, this would have been all postal banking all the time. but just briefly remind people why this would be such a great idea.
Right. So in the United States, there are significant amounts of people who have little or no access to banking services. Either they don't have the ability to get a bank account at all, or they have one, but they also use all these alternative sources like pawn shops or payday lenders or whatever. And those services charge extortionate rates. The average is something like, I think it was $2,500 a year in interest and fees on these alternative financial services for the average family. And these are families making $25,000 a year.
Right.
This is like 10% of their total income just on fees for conducting, you know, being part of the financial system. And in a modern economy, if you're not part of the financial system, you can't get a job or rent a car. I mean, there's so many things you can't do. So the idea would be to go back to something we had from 1911 to 1967, where the post office provided a postal savings account that anyone could access that would give you the ability to have an ATM card, that would give you the ability to conduct financial transactions. And it would be a way to promote financial inclusion, which is squarely within the mission of the U.S. Postal Service to bind the nation together. So this would not only help a little bit on the Postal Service's finances. You could charge vastly less for, you know, lending services or things like that in terms of interest. So families would save 80%, 90% in fees and interest. But the Postal Service would make a little bit of money and, more important, promote financial inclusion.
After Medicare for All, that's my
Number two.
That's number two on number my bucket list.
But this task force said no, can't do that.
This task force just is. I mean, it's just going to be operative during the Trump years, right? I mean, theoretically, right?
Right. But I mean, the logic of it, I think, is going to endure to a certain extent.
I hope so. All right. Well, let's talk about the House. There's two things I want to talk about. Where are we on the? And I think it was one of your buddies over at The Intercept, Ryan Grimm, who wrote about progressives getting on to, you know, getting 40%. Oh, you wrote that?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I'm sorry.
When in doubt, just assume.
You know, it's you. But then, okay. So you wrote this piece where the Democrat, the Progressive Caucus, and we spoke about it on the show a couple weeks ago. Okay. What's the latest on that? Anything new?
Okay, so just to
AOC
refresh,
is going for the that's what it was.
Ways and Means, yeah.
Grimm,
Ryan wrote about that.
Okay.
So, yeah, the latest is that the Progressive Caucus, as we talked about, made a deal with Nancy Pelosi. They used their power because Pelosi needs almost every Democrat to vote for her on the floor of the House on January 3rd in order to become Speaker.
Have you heard anything to the effect that she doesn't have that?
Well, I haven't heard definitively that she does have 218 votes, but I think she's moving in that direction.
Okay.
But at the time, a few weeks ago, it was a little bit less clear, and she needed to, you know, sort of give members who were wary, you know, little chits.
Right.
And one of them that the Progressive Caucus secured was proportional representation on these so-called money committees. And what are the money committees? Ways and Means, which does tax policy, Energy and Commerce, which does health care and climate change and a host of other things, Financial Services, which obviously does banking and housing policy, and Appropriations, which is all the money and where it goes in the various parts of the government. Those committees all have less than 40% representation for the Progressive Caucus. The Progressive Caucus is around 40% of the entire Democratic Caucus. So there was a deficiency there, and the co-chairs of the caucus, Mark Pocan and Pramila Jayapal, said, we want to up that. They were running into a problem, and the problem was that they couldn't find as many people as they needed to get onto these committees. The newer members were – they just kind of didn't know the importance of these committees. In the piece, there was a quote from Alex Lawson who said to me, progressives – come to Congress to change the world, and new Democrats and centrists come to Congress to get on the Ways and Means Committee.
Right,
like they are very hyper targeted.
It's like a cultural
almost
predisposition against these things.
Exactly. So, progressives have 75% of the Judiciary Committee. That's like kind of where they hang out, like cliques at the the tables and lunch. And then with existing members, the problem was that they have their own committees. And these exclusive committees are supposed to be things that you can't also serve on a different committee. on. So if you're on Ways and Means, you shouldn't. You're not allowed necessarily to serve on another committee.
And there's a certain dynamic here that is similar to what we're seeing in the Senate regarding Joe Manchin's ascension to the Energy Commission, sort of the ranking minority, or really the minority leader on that committee, and that seems like it's going to happen. That's a separate issue, but the dynamic is similar insofar as you need people to come in and either give up seniority on another committee and come into another committee where they wouldn't necessarily have the same.
It started at the ground floor. Exactly. And so all this seniority and, you know, the Congress runs on seniority. You want a subcommittee chairmanship. You want a committee chairmanship. You got to put in the time.
And if I'm fighting for climate change, let's say.
I want to be on that energy committee.
But if I'm fighting for I want to be on the energy committee. Well, I guess
maybe there, you want to be on the natural resources. If you're into armed services, you know, if you're in the foreign affairs.
Part of this is tied to what their constituency wants or what they perceive their constituency wants or what their brand is and what it's easier for them to brand themselves or where they're getting funding and whatnot. And on some level, there's a certain amount of re-education that has to happen.
Right.
For the House members and how they can re-educate their constituents and say, like, hey, this is important. It has value to you that I'm on this committee.
Right. And so it was, you know, there was some difficulty. I think it's sort of moving through. One thing that happened, so Barbara Lee lost this leadership race against Hakeem Jeffries.
Look at Michael. He's
the Democratic chair.
No, I know. It's annoying. It's annoying.
That was outrageous.
So Nancy Pelosi gives Barbara Lee a seat on the what is called the Steering and Policy Committee. And she actually opened a third seat for a third co-chair. There were already two co-chairs. She made a third co-chair for Barbara Lee.
So
on
she's
this committee.
Taking power away from those other two existing ones.
And giving it to Barbara Lee.
Who are the other
what guys? Is this? Rosa DeLauro and Eric Swalwell, who are like loyalists to Pelosi. What does that committee do? It makes the committee assignments. It recommends the members and where they go. It builds the seating chart for what members go on what committees. So this is giving a progressive icon who all the progressives, or many of them at least, supported the ability to have a seat at the table to build out that committees. So that's important. The second thing is this AOC thing. So Ryan wrote about this. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was linked to a couple different committees, but now she's zeroed in on the Ways and Means Committee, the Tax Writing Committee. Now, there's this weird custom that someone from New York City has to be on the Ways and Means Committee. I don't know where it came from. I don't know why it is, but a member representing New York City must be on the Ways and Means Committee. Previously, the member from New York City that served on that committee was Joe Crowley. So AOC is making the argument, that's my spot. I beat him. I want that seat. There's another member who is angling for it, and that's Tom Suozzi, who is part of Queens and then Long Island.
More Long Island.
Much more Long Island.
Queens is Long Island, let's be honest.
Well,
not
but it's part of the city. It's part of the city.
Yeah, but Queens part is of
the,
Long Island.
Yeah, I know, but we're one of the technicality.
Cool,
here.
Blah,
on a technicality,
blah, blah, blah.
He represents New York City at some level. So he's also gunning for that seat. So it's the choices between AOC.
It's almost the perfect sort of like metaphor microcosm for all of it, right?
Right.
In terms of the Democratic Party.
I think Hakeem Jeffries and Barbara Lee was up there too, as far as a microcosm conflict.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, but that is, in that instance, it's, you know, their fellow members voting for them, and some doing it under the auspices of misinformation that was put out there by Joe Crowley about the idea that Barbara Lee
wrote about that as
well. Well, you wrote about that.
I did not write. Ryan wrote about that, but apparently he. Yeah,
Joe Crowley told a significant number of members of the caucus that Barbara Lee had contributed to AOC's campaign in the primary.
Well, I think he just said she contributed, and then people drew their own conclusions.
And they were like, well, we're not going to vote for leadership who's willing to use their leadership power to take out incumbents,
right?
Because everybody is self-interested.
And so the truth was
that she did it after she won the primary, right. Like Steny Hoyer, like
just
every
like everybody
other,
else,
like everybody else did.
Right.
God, it's like all the bad parts of Leninism and none of the good parts.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And so
she did call Joe Crowley a white devil.
That was.
Yeah. What does it say?
Oh wait, I said that.
Was that on the floor?
Yeah, she said this devil.
But that, I mean, that is
holding the seat from this brave young yellow woman.
And you get the sense that Pelosi was not happy with the way that vote turned out.
Well, I mean, it is interesting that she then felt the need to compensate, but that is also caucus management. Right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Because it was a close race.
But she wouldn't have done the same thing with Hakeem Jeffries.
I don't know. Maybe she would have. I don't know.
I just don't get that sense. Maybe she would have. But I think that like she knew the Hakeem Jeffries vote, I think, caused her more problems than it would have if Lee had won.
I think that's fair.
That's my sense. But briefly, let's just talk about for a moment the Joe Manchin. How effed up is that? What is wrong with Chuck Schumer?
Well, is it Chuck Schumer? I mean, so
it's the Baileys.
As we said, this whole thing runs on seniority. The Congress runs on seniority, and so the precipitating event is Cantwell, right? So Cantwell is taking over a different committee.
Right.
I'm not sure which committee, but she wants to take over a different committee. And that opens up a spot on this energy committee. And there are three members who are on the committee who have seniority over Manchin, but they all already chair their own or ranking member on their own committees. So Wyden already is ranking member on the Finance Committee. Bernie Sanders.
And you can only be ranking member on one committee.
That's correct. Bernie Sanders already on the Budget Committee. Stabenow already on Agriculture. So you tick them off, and the next one on the list is Manchin, right? And environmentalists are apoplectic about this. At first, I think there was a lot of at least on anti-Bernie Twitter, there was a lot of blame for Bernie. Oh.
Well, because because Politico wrote this, was it Politico or somebody wrote this piece that framed it as if it was Bernie Sanders' fault,
right?
As opposed to, but from my perspective, look, first off,
common sense leadership.
Here's why it's Schumer's problem.
Okay,
because Schumer is the leader of the Senate,
right?
At least the Democrats in the Senate, and the idea that you are going to kneecap the Democrats by just from a rhetorical standpoint on climate change. Like, you're going to put one of the biggest advocates for coal, short of Mitch McConnell, on this committee, who, incidentally, is not just, you know, I don't even give him credit for being an earnest supporter of coal. I think he's just bought. And
I'm actually just super corrupt.
Yeah, exactly. I don't. I mean, it would be deep in my bones.
It's deep in my bones. Who
this
I am?
Just really, just about.
I'll tell you what, Jenks. Did you ever see that interview with him and Cenk Uygur? I know I always mention it, but the question on Yemen is still the best piece of spin I've ever seen in my life. I mean, he's like, "Why were you one of four Democrats?" This was another Yemen vote a year ago. Like, why were you one of four Democrats that voted not to suspend arms sales to Saudi Arabia? And he's like, "You know what, Cenk? I think that we could do a lot more to monitor the civilian casualties over there if we're participating in it." I don't trust the Europeans to have the same kind of oversight. Now, I'll tell you what.
When you're riding shotgun, you can tell what you've run over.
No, exactly. He's like, "I think a civilian casualty is more like killing innocent children is what it's more like." He literally. I was like, that guy's got it.
So I'm looking. I mean, so you say, well, what can Schumer do about it?
Well,
so
I'll tell you what Schumer
do. Here's what we can do. Looking at Manchin.
I like how David Dane literally has like. I have the actual list of literally what he could do.
I'm looking at Manchin's committee assignments.
Right.
So Manchin sits on appropriations. You're not going to be able to kick out someone in appropriations and give him that. He's on intelligence. And he's on Veterans Affairs. So I'm not sure exactly at the moment who is the ranking member on Veterans Affairs. It used to be Sanders. I don't know who it is now. But you could work a compromise and say, tell you what, Joe.
You get veterans.
You've got tons of veterans in West Virginia. Yep. We will give you the ranking membership of the Veterans Affairs Committee. It's a high-profile assignment, a lot of bipartisanship. That'll help you back home. And we'll give somebody else the Energy Committee. That's what a minority leader would do.
Exactly. Yeah.
That I'll is tell you what, point. Chuck. That's a real good Jew negotiating tactic. But I see a lot of campaign contributions.
Is this slander against me right now?
Slender against you? No, I think
no. But this is my point.
But
this
He's not going to give up.
No,
energy.
Chuck. No,
there's
but,
way too much money to raise.
Well, look,
energy.
There's plenty of money for him to raise there. But the thing is that Sanders. I mean, that Schumer can also like he can say, "Here's the carrot, and I have a stick, because we don't need you, Joe. We're in the minority now by four. Like you know, like you're deserting us. No longer has the power that it did." You know, 6 months ago.
Well, to be fair, he's got to think about when there's a 50-50 split and the Vice President O'Rourke or whoever is casting the deciding vote in 2 years. I mean, you know, it's not that easy to be the leader of the Senate caucus, but there is a way. You just give him Veterans Affairs.
Yes. Or you go to someone else, you know, some other, you know, senator and say, like, look, if you want to be in the minor, if you want to be in the majority, we're going to have to do things that are going to help the brand. It is going to be very problematic to go out there, particularly with a lot of young people
right.
who are going to, you know, the next presidential nominee, well, whoever it is going to be out there talking about the urgency of climate change. And we're going to look to the Senate and we're going to have a guy who literally is
a coal,
like just like, yeah, coal shoveling coal money.
And not to jump on Sanders, but he's the natural guy who you would say. Give it up for the team.
Unless you're Sanders and you're thinking there's a 50-50 chance.
I'm not going to be here. But
I'm not going to be here.
But if you're running on, I don't think it's going to be majorly problematic for him in any way. But, you know, the guy this week did a 2-hour, you know, a streaming thing on the Green New Deal. If there's any way in which he can be someone who say, I'm going to step up and I'm going to take over this committee because I'm going to run on climate change in 2020.
He doesn't know that he's going to run yet. That's the problem.
You know what? And also what's happening.
He doesn't
know
that he's going to run.
I think he's almost definitely going to run, but I think this is a coordinated attack.
Is it?
David Dane is
I
doing
did.
With well, other pro-Warren.
Well, I was going to get to that. Yeah, I was going to get to that.
There's but, no but doubt what's going on.
I think the fact that he won't take this is indicative that he doesn't know yet. That he's going to run. He may end up running. He may end up not. But I don't think he knows right now. Because if he did,
if you had to bet money, what would you go with, though?
If I had to bet money at this point, I would think now, really, in the wake of like, you know, what happened with Elizabeth Warren,
we're talking sort of, DNA gate.
Yeah, okay. that I think from a political standpoint, the takeaway from that was like, she's not staffed properly. Her political team is not you know up to par, and I think from Sanders' perspective, it's like if he thought that she could win, I think he would step down.
I wanted to sit this one out, but
he would sit it out. But I think honestly, and so I don't think he knows enough because I think if he did know, then he would do that maybe and get by Schumer another 2 years.
I don't know that he would do it if he did know necessarily because I don't know that Bernie thinks that way.
In terms of like a,
I think he likes being on. First of all, I think he likes being ranking member of the Budget Committee, even though it's not that important a committee in the grand scheme of things. But he gets to talk about every part of the budget, which means he gets to talk about all of his domestic policy at once. So that's number one. And I just think you know he's not weedy like that. This is a weird issue, right?
Right.
About seniority and things like that, and it's just sort of popped up. So you know, maybe he will come around and do that. But I ultimately think Schumer is the one who needs to forge the compromise.
Do you know who the Baileys are?
The Baileys would compromise.
What
on
would
this
the Baileys
issue.
Do, Dave?
Right.
We got to get to the Baileys and tell them to get Schumer off his ass.
If you don't get to the Baileys, it's not going to happen.
And you are...
The Baileys like clean air.
I meant to ask
theoretically,
you,
I don't know. I haven't talked to them. That's a special connect.
Mrs. Bailey's a little bit on the fence.
I think Mrs. Bailey...
Mrs. Bailey likes compromise.
I did literally read several years ago because I wanted to do more Bailey's background research to make fun of Chuck Schumer. And he's at a Chinese restaurant. And one of the things he's like, the Baileys don't want small cars. The Baileys like SUVs. So that wasn't a positive.
Don't the Baileys own an entire Irish cream industry?
No. They're middle class Massapequa Baileys. They don't.
They're heirs to the Irish.
They don't hate black people, but
I want to prove that I reach out to the
we used to call them
Irish
those
Catholics.
People. Anyways, let's negotiate, Mr. President. You want any more judges confirmed?
The Irish and the Jews were always good friends down on the.
He's off.
I meant to ask you at the beginning of today's episode because I feel obligated to now. Are you part of this cabal trying to push Beto O'Rourke out of contention in the primary?
No comment. No.
Not
at all.
Ooh.
Where's the Perry Mason music?
Here we go.
What is the cabal?
Oh, it's
that's exactly what you say.
I was on a plane. Part of the
cabal. That is what I would say, right?
Yeah. Right. Cabal?
No, I was on a plane yesterday.
What is cabal? I see. Plausible deniability.
Right.
I was on a plane.
Don't launch the first attack until I'm in the air.
I was in a plane.
We rally at dawn.
Apparently, Elizabeth Brunig wrote a piece that highlighted that Beto O'Rourke had, has taken some not great votes, but also was involved in working on a pretty predatory real estate business, I think, in Texas. And
it was also like, but I have to say, I mean, it was a great piece, but it was also like the piece that someone like me would echo in the sense that I like Beto O'Rourke. I hope he runs for Senate in Texas. I don't hate the guy. It's just it's ludicrous that people are talking about him as a contender. And if you're on the left, you have serious policy disagreements with him. I would add one addendum, and I know we've made this point before. Any conversation that's talking about a candidate that lost – as a potential presidential candidate, why is Stacey Abrams not at the top of this list? In fact, I would suggest – I mean, we've talked about the pool of voters that were disenfranchised could have made up the margin she lost by. I feel comfortable calling it a stolen race. She did an incredibly impressive job. And I think especially because the people who are sort of the biggest – sort of promoters of this Beto thing are the pseudo woke performative people that are always going to go on Bernie off of like fake identity issues. It's very bizarre that they aren't embracing Stacey Abrams, who's an incredibly impressive person who should be in, I would say, VP, frankly.
I mean, I wonder if, if it's a function of Stacey Abrams not necessarily. I mean, look, people are talking about Beto O'Rourke about this way because they're being encouraged to.
Right.
I mean, it's not like he's sitting there like, it never even occurred to me. No, when people start talking about him as a potential candidate, it's because during the course of his campaign, a couple of people said, you're very charismatic. And he raised $30 million,
no doubt,
which is a tremendous sum for a somewhat quixotic campaign, theoretically. And he's promoting it. I don't know that Stacey Abrams is out there.
But I think it is organic, though. I do. I don't think it's all – I think especially in social media when people sort of pontificate about these things, I think some of it is
let me ask a couple things here. I just can't wait for the left to eat itself throughout this entire primary.
Right.
I'm really excited for where this goes. But
It's
no accident that Deval Patrick decided not to run this week.
Because of the Zach Carter piece?
No, it has nothing to do with the Zach Carter piece. It has everything to do with the Obama world saying, you're out.
We're going to clear
the
field.
We're going for
Beto.
No, I mean, not clear the field, but we're going for Beto. We're backing Beto.
Right, okay.
We're not backing you. And I think that played a major role because, as you recall, There was a lot of talk about Obama world backing
Deval Patrick.
Deval Patrick.
Yes.
And suddenly he decides, I'm not running this week. It's pretty early.
Well, let me put it this way. My sense would be that the message that they got from the Obama world and that piece that came out, the timing is not coincidental.
The piece was part of it, I think.
Well, no, but wait a second. You're missing my point.
No, and also there's real issues in terms of, like...
Yes, that's true.
His
but
family...
This is, but often the way these things work, okay, mm-hmm. is different parts of that world have different jobs to do.
Right.
One comes in and says, look, this
You're
is probably...
You're not saying Zach Carter is part of Obama.
No,
yes,
but
he's part
I'm not
of
saying
Obama
that Zach Carter is
nor
part
was
of...
He, nor is he... affected by anyone who would be part of Obama world saying, hey, you better write this piece.
No, but you write the piece because you have the information and the information starts flowing and it starts getting out there. And, you know,
I think the timing was interesting. I think Zach writes what Zach wants to write.
No, right? Of course. But you know how this works with spokespeople and communications people. They say, who's going to be good to write this piece? And they look
at... Yeah,
but
I just don't feel like anyone who would be in that position would... That Zach Carter would be the person they would go to.
I don't know that that was... I mean, I don't know.
Do we have Zach on the phone?
I don't know.
I'll ask him. Do you also know about the very sad, like, real thing when he was first governor of Massachusetts, how he almost resigned because of his wife having some very serious, like, anxiety and depression issues?
No, I didn't.
They've written and spoken about it publicly. So I actually also think his sense of this, the toll that this could take on my family, like, I know that that's like a talking
point. He made like
point.
A glancing
I don't
reference
think that
to
that's
that.
Total BS in his case.
No, I think there's all these factors. Genuine. I think it's all these factors. All right, but here's, let's get back to a moment for Beto, because look, I know you're on the fence here, but let me just bring in Chris Matthews to tell you what you need to do.
Matthews.
Here is Chris Matthews.
Here we go.
This is it. Really, is sort of
you're
like
David Dan. You're part of the cabal.
This is. We're going to look back on this in 16 months from now, like with fond.
Is the
like,
thrill
remember,
is back?
Remember the Beto?
Thrill up is
remember
leg
the Beto
back.
Wars? Yeah. Remember the Beto Wars of late 2018?
Of 18.
Here we go.
And we, the Democratic Party, have not given them an alternative. Let's talk about presidential politics, because I'm already thinking about 2020. I know you all are, too. CNBC's reporting that Democratic Congressman Beto O'Rourke of Texas' team has been fielding calls from senior operatives who worked on President Barack Obama's campaign in the pivotal states of Iowa and New Hampshire. As speculation continues about a potential presidential run by Beto in 2020, one columnist at the Washington Post has already questioned whether the Democratic rising star, Beto O'Rourke, is far enough left for the party. Elizabeth Brunig writes, we still have time to pick a politician with a bold, clear, distinctively progressive agenda and an articulate vision beyond something better than this, the literal translation of hope change campaigning. Beto's a lot like Obama, true. It's perhaps time for left-leaning Democrats to realize that may not be a good thing. Peter, I'm amazed by this. Here's a guy who has a electoral power. People like him. He's got charisma like Obama. And he had somebody on the left saying he's not left enough.
Well, there's a...
But explain that.
There's an amazing, wonderful blue-collar philosopher who once said, naivete in children is often charming. In adults, it's stupidity. That's political stupidity. For that person to write about antipathy towards Wall Street, oil and gas, welfare reform, those are all major issues that we need a president to deal with, not to simply scorn them and discard them. And second, I think Beto's in an incredible position, not necessarily about the presidency, but he's captured energy. And one of the failings of the Obama campaign in 2008 was that after we won, we never had a call to service. And I think Beto and his team are figuring out where do you take all that
bring
energy.
Get people in the act. Let me go to Ashley on this.
I don't know who that was. I don't know who that was, but I have a feeling. It doesn't feel like he's like got his fingers on the pulse.
They just found like some accountant in New Jersey. They're like, hey, you want to be an asshole on Chris Matthews' show?
By the way, so Trump beat Clinton in Texas by 9 points. Beto comes within, what is it, 2, 3?
3.
Trump lost by 2 points nationally. Democrats won in 2018 by 8 points.
Right.
It's the same swing. It's the same spread.
There's
it's the
no,
exact
words,
same spread.
He did not outperform.
No, he performed exactly as well
as
everyone
everybody else.
Else.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, but he's so inspiring, not like that boring Obama guy.
Well, you know what I noticed about those posters? Do you see it?
What?
That's the exact, those Beto posters are identical to Obama's posters in 2004.
The Viva Beto?
No.
In 04.
Yes. The Senate poster, because I have one of those from 2004. And
it's up in your room,
it
above
is,
your bed.
It is above my bed. I look at it every
on
night.
On the ceiling?
Change.
It's still possible. If I move the O over here and I take out this part of the B, it's Beto. It's very similar, like just that big lettering up there at the top of the sign. But all right. Well, is there more sound here? Yeah. Let's keep playing it. I don't know who this guy is.
Yeah,
it's like more Kondracki.
Somebody call in or write in. Yeah.
They just took him off like the LIR or something.
In the act. Let me go to Ashley on this. It seems to me that if the Democratic Party sets as a standard, you must be Bernie. In other words, an avowed socialist. I'm not knocking it, but if that's the political goal line you're setting up, if this person isn't for so-called Medicare for everybody all life, if they're not for free tuition payback, if they're not for all these social programs, if they're not for a big role for the government and the economy, then they're not Democrats. If that's the standard, you're going to knock out a lot of candidates.
Well, let's look at this, though. The DNC...
Now, pause it. Hold on. Let me just say this. I think that Elizabeth Brunig... sitting atop of where she sits, choosing who gets to be Democrats is wrong. I don't know who gave her this power, but I mean, should anybody have that power?
Probably not.
I don't even think that she... Yeah. She all right.
If that's the standard, you're going to knock out a lot of candidates.
Well, let's look at this, though. The DNC itself was against Bernie Sanders, and they set parameters to make sure that he would not get enough support and not have the support he needed. And let's go back to superdelegates and all of that. So I do think the establishment in the Democratic Party will not allow someone too progressive to get back in.
Because, well, I don't know. That's, what about the voters?
So now here's the interesting
piece. Let's talk about winning
a game.
How do you beat Trump?
You've got to get to the suburban, middle-class, blue-collar voters. And they need to start thinking about that Obama-Trump flip that happened in 2016.
Blue-collar voters?
Middle-class blue-collar voters.
Wait, who are those guys?
The Westchester County folks who just go over to the car factory out in Westchester County.
They live in Briarcliff Manor. They make $500,000 a year, and they drive upstate to work in Rochester.
What? What is – who are the suburban blue-class – middle class blue collar workers.
It's like as he grabbed his macchiato.
There are
on
six
his
of
way
them, and
they're
highly influential.
We have them all here on our list, and so we know
they're
them.
In
we,
this panel right now. This blue
I
ribbon
know
panel.
Who it is. It's the Baileys. Yeah.
The
all right,
the
let's
Baileys
continue on.
Middle class blue collar.
You've got to get. How do you beat Trump?
You've got to get to the suburban middle class blue collar voters, and they need to start thinking about that Obama Trump flip that happened in 2016. That again flipped in 2018. If you do not focus on that, which they're moderate swing voters.
Your ears to
I'm not
mouth,
going
God's
to vote
ears.
For a progressive.
I am completely.
I would vote for a Joe Biden, not a Beto.
Okay, Alina, how do you get the people in the industrial states who flip from Trump to the Democratic candidates for senator and governor in Michigan? Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, right. The whole.
I know. I totally agree. It's like she's only talking about the primary, which is one thing. But it's let's move on to the general
election. You know what they used to say back in the 60s?
What's
NDC,
that?
November doesn't count. The hard left would say, as long as we win the primaries, it doesn't matter. George McGovern. But that mentality's out there, Peter. It's out there now. George, I just saw in the paper today.
Wow. They should definitely still be afraid of.
Beto O'Rourke is too much like Obama. That's a problem?
At least 100,000 people in Maryland are still alive.
Yeah. Wait. Okay. Yeah. The it is well, but this is
going to be McGovern,
right? This is generational. I mean, this is what has been problematic with the Democrats for a long time is that the baby boomers still hold, because of the size of their generation, still hold too much sway over essentially the conventional wisdom, and you know the idea that you can draw any parallels now between George McGovern and anybody in like there's no it is.
Well, I mean, to draw a parallel with George McGovern, you have to find a candidate who is broadly seen on the anti-war left, who was hated by unions.
Right. Like, yeah, exactly.
Like, who is that parallel today?
With reason, too, right? He was the one who cut the union's power out from under them and picking who...
I mean, it was a little bit more complicated. Unions were strongly pro-war at that point. George Meany himself was...
A little bit of an overstatement.
He tried. He was so pro-labor. He tried so hard to get the unions on his side, and they just totally
snubbed
him. That's
correct. Yeah, I mean, it's not that he was anti. It's the unions were
where
strongly against him.
Where he went bad was his reaction to it led him to later in his career do, like, anti-card check propaganda, which is really
interesting. But it's an interesting comparison, right? Because the things that sank McGovern back then were very, very different from the things that the centrists are saying would sink Bernie right now.
Right.
A lot of things that sunk McGovern with the socially conservative unions were things that every Democrat supports now, things known as identity politics, right?
Yeah.
Minority rights, gay marriage, drug laws, anti-war, etc. Whereas, and their economic policies were actually very much in line with his. And now it's the economic policies.
Amnesty, acid abortion.
Yeah. Now it's Bernie the economic policies that they're saying are too left. So it's like really a bad comparison.
As long as Bernie doesn't pick a vice presidential nominee who was treated for clinical depression, I think he'll be fine.
Right, right, right. Now, we should also say that I think part of the animosity came from the commission that McGovern co-chaired to... That changed the way that our primaries ran. I mean, they actually created primaries as opposed to a back room where unions had a tremendous amount of power in basically picking who the nominee was.
That's true. I'm totally bummed. I really thought that Chris Matthews was going to develop a crush on AOC and become a Democratic Socialist.
She's got it.
I totally lost it. Well, I thought he was just going to be like, I mean, this is the problem with oligarchs.
But what's this is what's what's fascinating to me? Well, I guess it's not that fascinating to me. I mean, the idea that
that's a good setup.
I think it's fascinating.
Aren't we? Aren't we?
Is it or isn't it?
Well, I mean, I should know better at this point. Like, it should be completely boring to me.
Oh, you actually would expect better than that?
No, it's just I don't believe. Like, you know, like the idea that there are folks who are willing to already sort of like. Who think they're playing this poorly is my point. Is the forces that want a Beto are playing this poorly because they are polarizing too early. It just
way
seems to me
too early.
It is way too early to sort of like complain about the idea that there are people who are pointing to Beto's record and saying, hey, this is problematic. What you should be doing is you push back on his record. You should be building him instead of...
I'll help him. You know, there's one vote that I've seen put out there that O'Rourke voted for, some financial deregulation vote. That bill never became law. That the vote that is being pointed to is something that was just one of the many deregulatory measures that the House passed that never got through the Senate. The one that did, the deregulatory bank bill, the one big bipartisan bank deregulation bill this year, Beto voted against it. So just do that instead of presuming a cabal.
They're scared. They're scared, man.
I think actually it's surprising to me too, because I think there's actually a lot of people like me who obviously will support Bernie over Beto because we're left, but like I have no particular antipathy or hostility to him at all, and they're fast tracking.
That's
like,
what I'm saying.
Yeah, no,
I'm talking
totally
completely
right.
From a strategic
totally right.
standpoint.
Right.
This is
right.
not the time where you set this up.
Totally.
You set up this because it's not going to be helpful.
Totally.
It certainly wasn't helpful during the 2016 primaries, and those forces are not as well situated as they were then. Mm-hmm. And so it's a big mistake.
Although Beto's a better candidate than
it's
Hillary.
A big Ooh, mistake. Yes,
I dislike
but my point is, yes, but my point is, you don't want to make this about the so-called Bernie bros versus these, Beto. They're doing it more
doing
than others are.
I mean, Elizabeth Brunig said already, she said, we're already at that time where, I think, I forget how she, I mean, there was a couple of other things, but she's like, we're already at that time where I'm a white male, magically.
Right.
Like, well, she's like, we're not even like in the friggin' election cycle yet, and all this garbage is
happening. My biggest
already.
Problem was with Maloney. And Beto sort of coming in, I think he endorsed Maloney in the New York AG race, if I remember correctly.
Oh, Sean Patrick Maloney.
Yes.
Oh, that was a trash move.
And that hurts makes me nervous.
Yeah.
As to what's, like, something's, like, all that low-key stuff.
What makes me nervous is that the it's still 2018 on the calendar, and
right.
we're already at each other's throats.
What makes me nervous is
well, but that's my point.
It's
like, I don't, I think, like, they're escalating. I mean, I think like Neera Tanden escalated this in a useless, silly way. Do we put up?
That's what she
does.
Put
it back up. Put it back up. I mean, well, I understand, but somebody should somebody there should be somebody.
Well, the truth
in that
is,
world
is that
says,
everyone's
like, hey,
still fighting the 2016 prime.
But I felt like that stuff had sort of had
nope. Have you been on Twitter
still
lately?
Fighting the
well,
and Neera Tanden is on the front lines of the 2016.
Yeah, she needs
the
law.
Yeah. The war of 2016.
Yeah, she should get offline.
Maybe
sure.
it's like
when Andrew Jackson in 1814 was still fighting that battle of the War of 1812. Like she's still fighting the War of 2016.
I know it.
She's
she
like
always will
she's
be.
Like one of the people in the hills in Japan that hasn't
right,
heard
right,
that
right,
World
right,
War
exactly.
II is over.
World War II,
except
1975, they find
right.
the guy's in a cave.
Yeah, except that guy would still like be running a division
positions,
of the Japanese
yeah, in
military.
A position of power.
That's the problem.
Well, maybe
right.
running propaganda operations.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
If,
right.
If I may, maybe it's time for the hard left to flex its muscles a little bit and remind the people in the political class that and in the ruling class that the Elizabeth Brunig option, the Bernie option, that is a nice option. People are angry. And if we don't get what we want in the electoral sphere, or even if we do, we're going to have some widespread unrest outside of it.
Well, yeah, I don't think that's going to happen on Twitter. I don't think that's
yeah,
a place
is.
For that. To,
no,
I mean,
certainly not. But, you know, maybe have a wildcat strike or two. Put the fear of God in them.
I'm
only the left is so weak
wildcat
that
strikes.
That's probably not going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I just it's just what we're talking about here has nothing to do with people who would do a wildcat strike. It has only to do with like what the political class is doing. I mean,
has,
this is
has
a
nothing
silly,
to do with people's lives.
Yes,
I would
nothing.
Argue.
Yeah,
like,
exactly. Exactly.
You know, and we just talked about this bank that was you know doing bad credit report reporting. On thousands of people, and you know, what does this have to
there's
do with
well,
it?
No, they
but
still view
real policy. I mean, I just they, have to say, like, I would say, like, and I'm pro Bernie, whatever, but isn't it really clear that, I mean, if specifically on the issues you're talking about, I mean, I think Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are definitely the only candidates that I would absolutely trust on that.
I think Sherrod Brown is pretty
and Sherrod
good on
Brown,
stuff like
runs.
That. And
Sherrod Brown, but those three.
What I'm
Merkley,
saying is,
I think, it's pretty
he's
good.
He's not
on,
running. I'm like, talking about.
Is he
candidate.
Not?
They
I have not
still,
heard he's running. That would be interesting.
They're still trying to
Merkley has talked about running. We have 34, to my count, Democrats that have talked about running in
wow.
a serious way.
Jesus Christ.
They're still 34. Trying to portray Bernie as this like hard left socialist, this extremist, and like the furthest left option that exists, when in fact he is a very moderate compromiser, as far as I'm concerned.
I'll tell you what, we should
I think you have to concede that within the context of American politics, Bernie Sanders is to the left of any candidate who people think actually has a chance of winning the nomination.
Yeah, sure. But the things he's proposing are not actually socialism. They're just common sense social democratic policies that every other country in the developed world has.
I'll
and
say one thing.
The more they can make him look crazy, the more they drag that window
like
of possibility
that
window
they
back over to the
by
right.
Saying he looks crazy.
Yeah, I feel like that window
all
has
backfired.
Been shut.
Because the play of the smart ones, and this is the difference between Obama and Clinton people. It's really subtle. Obama people get, oh, we should pretend to be closer to that.
Right.
The Clinton people are we're like, listening. That's crazy, and he's a white supremacist. Yeah.
Obama's people
like,
we're listening.
Yeah, the Obama people are like, oh, that's a really good point. Right. We're for like universal Medicare
this is what I find. Okay. Yeah. So this is what I find so strange about what's going on now. And maybe it's just rogue, you know, sort of Clintonites who are just mad about Bernie and mad about certain people.
Yes, they're.
But the point that you're making is that the Obama people are going to dress Beto up
100%.
As if he's like, I'm like practically a younger Bernie.
They're going to send him to the Wildcat strike on his skateboard.
Right, exactly. And,
how do you do, fellow leftists?
Absolutely.
And I think, you know, to the extent that Neera Tanden had a point about people being worried, I think there is a worry on the left that people are going to project onto Beto positions and a philosophy that he doesn't necessarily have.
I'm looking forward to O'Rourke getting his band together for a remake of Fight Song.
Oh, my God. Oh, don't even speak that into existence.
But do people remember at the beginning of this campaign, the beginning of his senatorial campaign, you heard a lot of like, look, he's not as progressive as he appears.
You did hear that originally.
And
he's a Texas congressman.
But he's from Texas. Yeah. And, there is a lot of sense on the left that a lot of people projected stuff onto Obama that was not there, that people did not realize that he was not an ideologue.
Boy, we haven't fallen into that trap again.
Well, I mean, what do you mean?
I feel like what you're saying, that he's sort of a blank slate.
Yeah, and been people
project projecting all your wishes and desires on white people.
What's happening now is I think you're getting people to say, like, look, don't project.
Right.
And,
right.
You know,
people
are pissed.
Yeah, I don't hate Beto, but that's just my – like, I actually kind of like him, but I just want to be very clear that this guy is not – if you're interested in a progressive candidate, this is not your pick.
If he becomes the eventual nominee, I wanted his liabilities to be known and articulated as being on the left.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, what does it say about the Democratic Party that they even need to have a progressive caucus in the first place? Like, isn't the party supposed to be progressive?
It's a coalition party.
It's a big party. I mean, it's I don't know what else.
I would say that, you know, in thinking about the role of the left in you know, this next cycle, it might be wiser, rather than staking out a position of supporting one candidate above all else, might be wiser to support certain issues and demand that every candidate move toward them.
Totally.
That would certainly put us in a better position after the election, should a Democrat be elected, to continue that.
Absolutely.
That's what the Bernie people are doing, but people keep accusing us of having
this
cult of personality.
That's what the Green New Deal is all about.
But the point is, if you analyze that statement, the Bernie people are doing this.
The people who support Bernie support him not because of who he is, but because of the policies that he represents.
But my point is, like, look at what AOC is doing on the Green New Deal. She has said, we need this particular committee because we have this crisis out there and we need to build legislation for it. And we need to go around to every member of Congress now, no matter who they are or who supported them, whatever, and said, are you going to support this Green New Deal commission? And she's got like 20 of them already in the space before she's a congressman, in the space of a week or two, to support it. And that seems to be, to me, to be the organizing principle.
But that's different
on
than picking
left.
A presidential candidate.
No, it isn't. It's saying,
no, but literally,
we have 10 candidates here. Are you going to support? This is what was done on healthcare without as much participation on the left. And so we got the healthcare we got. It was what was done on you build consensus and you say that this is a threshold issue.
But there are the only two roadblocks to that are, I mean, first of all, I think, you mean, of course, generically and generally that's true. And then it's like, OK,
I am generic.
No, I mean, it's true. It's, of course, you're right. But I think that, like, OK, so the thing that I keep hitting with Bernie is like no one is on the near him on those consensus issues on foreign policy. That matters to me, what your position on Brazil is, what your position on Yemen or the Iran deal is, or Israel. It matters to me. I don't think it's – so that's number one. He's still far ahead of the rest of them. And then number two, I think you have to decide at some point, like, do you really trust somebody's of those relative choices, I trust Bernie just even in terms of who he'll appoint to oversee Wall Street as an example. Or Warren, I trust her too, far more than I do trust Cory Booker as an example.
By the way, what Warren did in 2016 was create this idea of personnel as policy.
Right.
And she pinned down
– that's great
– Clinton on who she was
that's
going
great.
To appoint.
That's great.
And tried to disqualify certain people who were in Clinton's orbit – for appointments. So, I mean, there are ways to go about this that aren't just personality driven.
Yes,
but I didn't say anything about personality.
No, but the idea is that instead of what I think what David is suggesting is instead of starting with the person and assessing their issues, you come up with an issue set and you push those issues and you let people fall in line and then you start to assess, okay, have they adopted this position? Do I trust them? Now, you're also talking like we may have 9 months, 12 months, 14 months to make these people say it over and over and over in public in such a way that's like, it doesn't matter if you trust them or not. Like they're some obviously are within a certain zone, but the idea being that what makes the near attendants are doing now a mistake is they are forcing people to pick candidates much earlier than they should be.
Yeah, they're short-circuiting that whole process.
They're short-circuiting that whole process.
Look, I can
and
assure
on the left,
you that,
that can happen on that
Bernie
process
Bernie Sanders
too.
Comes out and he goes, I want more settlements in the West Bank and Lula should be in jail and privatize Social Security, I will not continue to support Bernie Sanders. I mean, I think that, like, of course, I actually think a lot of people, especially – that was the sort of distinguishing marker of Bernie's campaign, was actually people being more policy oriented.
Yeah.
And I understand that people – I get that people – there's personality cults around everybody. I get it. But that's – I mean, first of all, that applies just as easily to Hillary Clinton or Beto. But if you're really seriously talking about policy, there's major differences here. And there is also a background of credibility that people have and other people don't have. I mean, this is not that really – it seems pretty obvious.
Yeah, and it's not just about their platform in the moment, right? Like, we've heard everything before. We've heard so much progressive talk from so many people, from, Bill Clinton to Obama. Like, I want to see what they've done in the past. And Bernie has been bashing away at this stuff for decades.
Hey,
like, we know where he stands. Versus, if like a Hillary-type candidate came out and said, oh, yeah, Medicare for all is a great idea. And then you look at what they've done in the past, like, people might not trust them.
I mean, it's true. I mean, people definitely changed based upon the situation. I mean, I think Bernie is probably softer on guns than he was 5-10 years ago.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, they're really.
No, I mean, I know it's not your issue, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about a dynamic.
Yeah, they're foreclosing on the availability to make Beto a better candidate over all this, right? By short-circuiting all this immediately. Because it's not
right.
Like, Matthews's complaint wasn't that people are cultists about Bernie. It was that they're doing purity tests around issues like Medicare for everybody.
Right.
Stuff, right?
Exactly.
Right.
Well, and so
exactly.
He's stopping this process, and that's what all these people are doing.
Right. I mean, that's why you got to focus on the issue and not make it associated with the personnel at this point.
But there is going to be a certain point when you're like, okay.
Yes, I know.
I'm
but in 2018, the idea is
Bernie
not
Sanders
the,
to
the
do
idea
this
is not
throughout
to
2019.
Booker. Yeah, the idea
no,
in 2018, 2019 is not to start to apply the test. It is to create the test.
Sure.
And then if the test is created, sure. Then people are in a position to fail it or succeed in that extent.
Or right, to get pulled in directions.
Of course.
Let's talk about this for a moment because this is a great interview, Chris Hayes.
You're going like 5 minutes.
Okay, good. This will be the last thing we'll have you for. Let's. We mentioned North Carolina.
even Kris Kobach apparently now is recognizing there could be something wrong with the election in North Carolina.
What are Democrats trying to steal?
Ninth district. Yeah.
It's like Guatemalans came. That's
so
the problem.
Kris Hayes had on his program, I guess it was last night, the North Carolina Republican executive director. This is Dallas Woodhouse. Is he Leighton Woodhouse's brother or something like that? Or
no,
like,
no.
Different guy.
I got it.
Well, there is like two brothers, but...
No, that's Brad Woodhouse.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Who are the Woodhouses?
So, like a brother team that it's are on different sides. Yeah,
they're on opposite sides. Political divide.
Maitland-Carvel type of situation.
Yeah, got it.
All right, well, anyway, so Kris Hayes had on last night the North Carolina Republican executive director. And remember, the Republican Party in North Carolina has basically, I don't know what the numbers are, hundred thousand some odd have kept people off the voting rolls, have depressed voter turnout, all ostensibly based upon voter fraud. And this is the only real case that they've ever found. And this is not voter fraud. It is electoral fraud. Here is Hayes.
I do want to cite something you said in the days after the election where you said in a phone call, we are trying to keep Democrats from stealing the congressional race from Mark Harris. Now, that's obviously an incredibly loaded charge that you made. Do you want to apologize for that or take that back?
Or just change the name?
Well, no, because I made that call to donors of the North Carolina Republican Party, which you're not one of, I feel sure. But if you'd like to be, we're at 1506 Hillsborough Street in Raleigh, North Carolina. No, but I think this.
But you were wrong, right? I mean, your position was this is a sort of made-up scandal, and the Democrats are out to try to steal this out from under our noses. We won 905 votes. They're refusing to concede. That proved to be wrong, right? I mean, you get out over your skis. There was actual, apparently criminal activity.
Okay. what I would say is, you know, there are a lot of different things going on here. The ground is shifting under our feet. You know, I don't think you can excuse the Democrats on the State Board of Elections that all of a sudden drop this on our lap after no election protest was filed, after Mr. McCready conceded the election, after no recount was called for, and after all of the local boards of elections certified the race. We have never seen that
happen.
Wait a second. And sir, if I can just finish this one point, I apologize.
Will let you.
And at the same time, the state is engaged in a very difficult negotiation and fight over the control of the Board of Elections.
That I know.
And so the Board of Elections that's walking out the door simply comes out and says they're not going to certify, and at that time really don't say
right.
Why.
Okay.
I mean, of course we're going to be suspicious of that.
That's a process complaint. Let's put that to the...
Yeah, imagine this guy going like, you didn't find... that the money was missing from the bank until they had gotten away in the getaway car and they'd already crossed the bridge and paid their toll. And then all of a sudden they got to come back.
It's called Lily Ledbetter. Right? That is exactly what the court said in the Lily Ledbetter case. Lily Ledbetter was a woman who was discriminated against on pay for 20 years.
Yep.
And she found out about it years later and said, I want my back pay. I was doing the same job with this other guy, and he was making all this more money than me. And the court said, well, you didn't find out about it in time, so we're not going to do anything. And then Congress had to change the law.
Yeah.
So timeliness is a thing, but I don't know that it's a thing in this context. When there's obviously fraud. And
well,
when the Board
certified.
Of Elections did not
yet.
Certify
like,
the race.
That's the point, right? Certification is supposed to be like, we
nowhere.
Have cleared the deck of all the potential like rampant fraud that could have existed. And, oh, we found some before the certification. Right. Like, I mean, it's one thing to say like, okay, you serve your 2 years. And then, you know, 3 years from now, they go, hey, wait a second. There was some... Or even when they're a sitting congressperson.
Yeah, I think that the statute of limitations has not run out if
when they
the race
certified.
Has not been certified at all.
That's the whole point of the certification.
Right.
But his arguments were sort of, well, I was lying to my donors, not everybody.
I know, I like that.
And I almost got away
with
it.
Just doing my job.
Yeah.
Man, what do you want? You want to give me some money? And
I'm a propagandist.
That's right. Look, I'm a paid hack.
You hit me for cut a check. I won't lie on your show.
Right. I mean, what are you... Bear shits in the woods. I don't know what to tell you.
That's how you talk to donors. I don't know what you want from me.
People buy Alex Jones pills, Chris. What the hell you think?
Well, David Dayan, it has been a real honor and pleasure to have you in studio.
Always to be good in the set. Cedar Auditorium.
There we go. Here. Yes, in the massive. Yes. Yeah, you can see that we actually did put some.
I have some fans in the up rafters. In the third balcony.
David, thank you much for coming on. I hope most everyone, I think, who listens to this program has purchased your book, Chain of Title.
Very good.
And
good to hear.
They can find you. Where do you like to send people? To your Tumblr?
Sure. So daviddayan.tumblr.com.
And your tiny letter? You want to tell people about your
tiny letter? tinyletter.com/daviddayan is my bi-weekly, twice-a-week newsletter.
Only twice a week?
Usually twice a week. Okay. That includes links to everything I write about.
You know,
and
there's
a little bit more
theory going around yes, on this program that you don't actually exist. That
I've disproven that.
Well, you're just the guy they send in.
They still have a team in India.
They send you in.
Are you saying I'm a crisis actor?
I mean, look, I've noticed
you've
had
Milo.
I've noticed you had a headset on the whole time you've been here.
That's true.
You could be just somebody's like...
I'm a replicant, is what you're saying.
I'm saying there could be a guy in a van down in the street, you know, listening to the show, feeding you information as part of the team.
Talk about CFPB.
They're all typing away.
There's
the
like
this
Cyrano de Bergerac situation.
Yeah, he's
the
suave, personable, handsome face of a shady collective.
Exactly. Like there's a Soros-funded like traveling van out there with like 14 reporters, the communications van, and they're just the guy they send out to actually front it.
We're going to see David
well,
in like
a fair cop.
We're going to see him in an IBM Watson commercial or something like that.
They found Dane at some
Deep
bar.
Blue.
Yeah.
It's like, you know what postal banking is? Nah. You're going to learn it.
Yeah, now that I'm off the show, I can do it in my normal accent. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. This is like the Bourne identity. All right, David Dayan, thank you so much. All right, folks, we're going to take a break, head into the fun half. A reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. You become a member of this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. It is your membership that keeps this show humming along. Folks, I've got some good news and I've got some bad news. The good news is you still have maybe a week or two to buy tickets to the Brooklyn Podfest. When I said that, when I said you may have a week or two, I'm going to show you what Brendan did. Like this. He did one of those where he shook his head back and forth and was like, I wouldn't promise that. We are now down below to what? One quarter of the seats left? A little bit less. A little bit less. If you want to purchase a ticket to see the Majority Report live on January 13th at the Bell House, you need to do so very, very quickly, ladies and gentlemen. You can head over to majority.fm. You will get details there. Pick up your tickets. Also, there's been some confusion. For the next couple of, next week or so, you can purchase justcoffee.coop coffee for 30% off. You do not need to use a coupon code majority. You do not need to do that. They're having a special promo, 30% off. This is the time where you go there and you buy the Majority Report blend because you've never tried it before and you want to see if it's as good as we've been saying it is, because it is. Free shipping, 30% off. Buy a 5-pound bag if you're smart. Unless you're like one of those people who are like, I have to have my coffee like incredibly fresh. I can't have a 5-pound bag. Or if you own a store, there you go. Boom. So check that out. Michael?
February 1st, Bell House, Michael Brooks Show. Tickets, we're at the halfway point. And with February 1st coming around the bend. So get those tickets quickly as well. Michael Brooks Show on Patreon, patreon.com/TMBS to get everything. Our YouTube channel and iTunes. Thanks.
Who is on this week?
This past week, Mike Racine was on. Very funny comedian. We did a lot of Dave Rubin impressions. He has a great Dave Rubin impression.
Does he really?
He really legitimately has a great Dave Rubin impression. He caught it. He said he's a South Park character.
Yeah, you'd need to do him like a South Park.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah, did you see? I mean, she's ideas. He nailed it. We had a great time. George H.W. More like George H.W. Bad was the title. Next week, Matt Taibbi in studio.
Oh, I should also say, Jamie, we'll talk about the Intifada, but I want to just do this in the fun half of the program. I am holding a mug. I think I have an idea who gave it to me. For Hanukkah, I guess it was a Hanukkah mug. It says, Ask the Moms, and then a tiny majority .fm right there. So Ronald Reagan, I think, was responsible for this.
Maybe.
Ask the Moms.
Ask the Moms. It could have been. It could have been many, but I think he's already got these up at his redirected, seamless page or whatever. I don't know what a threadless or whatever it is. Again, I don't know what it is. But he said something was on the way, and I was a little bit worried. And he was like, don't worry, it's practical. I know that you need a practical gift. And Jamie, what's happening on the Intifada?
Yeah, so this week on the Intifada, out now, Sean and I recap our magical trip to Mexico, including our visit to the autonomous Zapatista community of Oventique. And we talk about the, that's very nice, the amazing experience we had there and the beautiful way they govern their society along horizontalist principles. Also this weekend we are recording an episode with Justin Akers Chacone, author of a book called Radicals in the Barrio: Magonistas, Socialists, Wobblies, and Communists in the Mexican-American Working Class. And it was partially inspired by the bad take that Angela Nagel published that made everyone mad a couple weeks ago, but it's something I'd been meaning to do for a while. So
you waited till Michael went to the bathroom before you said that.
Oh, is he in the bathroom? I didn't notice.
Matt.
Tonight, finally, me and my friend Chris are going to talk about democracy and chains.
Finally.
We're going to talk about James Buchanan and if he's sort of like a libertarian Machiavelli or if he's a libertarian Forrest Gump.
Wow, nice. All right. All right. Quick break. Oh, wait. Have we started on, Brendan, are we on Pandora yet?
I believe so. You download the app.
Yeah, folks. If you ever, we're on Pandora. If you want to check out, if you have Pandora, check out the Majority Report. I think we just were one of the early invitees onto Pandora. Just us and NPR and some of the other little players.
We're taking
players,
them down.
Some of the little players. I think we could be one of the few independent news podcasts on Pandora. Show them.
Get our numbers up if you got it.
Let's see NPR do a show on, you know, postal banking as like the most exciting part of the episode.
I mean, the people I've talked to that have worked at NPR are all jealous of the type of content we get to do here. So
is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Boom. All right, quick break. Head into the fun half. We'll be right back. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous? You're a little bit upset? You're riled up?
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're
You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite.
I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Wow. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.